You're listening to Big Cast, your source for financial technology innovation.
Welcome back to another episode of the Big Cast. My name is Glenn Sarvati from 154 Advisors here on behalf of Best Innovation Group, where we like to do cool things with technology in the financial services industry. And I'm going to take a wild guess that we've got a few new and extra listeners this week, because that's just kind of what happens when you have words like cannabis and cryptocurrency in the description. And we're going to talk about both of those things in detail. But before we get too far into it, I just want to mention that if you're here expecting puns and double entendres and nudges and winks around cannabis, you've come to the wrong place. So you can drop out now. We are going to take a good close look at the cannabis banking industry and what's been happening in that space, and what to me is just a really bizarre catch-22 about the difficulty of dealing with the financial services side of what has increasingly become a legal industry. And we'll get into more of that. I do want to say right off the bat, the driving factor for this is a cover story that I wrote for Credit Union Magazine. It's the summer issue. It's on the newsstands. I'm not sure if it's technically on the newsstands, but you can find it in the current issue. And it is on cannabis banking. And I would like to thank three of the trailblazing credit unions who spoke to me in detail about this, and also just for the good work that they've done in terms of really getting out in front of things in dealing with this topic. And that's Rachel Pross from MAPS Credit Union, Lynn Ciani from Numerica, and James Collins from OB Credit Union. They're all out there on the West Coast, which is really more coincidental. That happens to be the states that have legalized cannabis recreationally more rapidly, which has created some of this opportunity. But they've all been very generous with their time and thoughts. So hopefully you'll check out that article. And I think it's a good companion piece to the conversation we'll be having with Deirdre O'Gorman, who is, she wears many hats currently with Imperial Logistics and DX Consulting, also the Fourth Quarter Credit Union. Most rapidly, I'd just say she is a, you know, one of the key early movers in the cannabis banking industry. So we're catching up with her and getting into a little bit more detail on a lot of the topics that we've touched base on in the article as well. Before we get into that, breaking news this week, although it had been rumored for some time, Facebook has finally launched, launched is not the right word, they've announced their plans and given a little bit more color around their new cryptocurrency, blockchain-based coin called Libra. Of course, that catches our interest immediately here because we've spent a lot of time on distributed ledger technology and the like. So John Best, the grand poobah here of this podcast, he has already done a good bit of work on this, and he's the hacker of the crowd. So he actually got under the covers and played with some of the code that's out there a little bit. So we caught up very quickly just to get initial impressions on that. So let's take a listen. Okay, so John's here with me. I got this, we're doing this real time because the news broke on Facebook's new cryptocurrency Libra, which is actually being set up as an independent entity with a bunch of partners. John, I know you've been giving this some thought, and you've already made a video, which we'll post a link to, which takes a little bit more of a, is it fair to say, a hacker's approach, just kind of getting your hands dirty and starting to kind of play with some of that code?
I had a site, and it said, here's how you install it, and I know how to do that sort of thing, so... And one way to kind of learn what the purpose of the car is to look in the engine and drive it around a bit.
So if you're interested in that, we can we'll post a link to that one. And I know you're also going to be sharing probably thoughts in a little bit more detail with Brett King on Breaking Banks by the time that should be posted, I think, by the time this runs as well.
Yeah, they asked me today to talk about it. So I'm going to jump on and talk about kind of what this means for banks and fintechs and what it really is, what it isn't, those sorts of things.
Well, with that in mind, not to steal Brett's thunder here, but on the big deal-o-meter, where do you place this one? Is this something that people should be getting pretty jazzed about?
Yeah, so if the big deal-o-meter is a 1 to 10, right, had Zuckerberg come out on stage and announced this and then, you know, said, oh, by the way, everyone turn around. There's a pile of Facebook wallets right behind you.
Is that the Oprah approach or the Steve Jobs approach?
Steve Jobs approach. And then also before he left the stage was just in a big bag of Facebook coins, tossing them out into the audience. I would have called it a 10. As it is, it seems I was trying to figure out why they did it. And the only thing I could come up with is it was about to be broke anyways, because it's not quite finished.
No, you clearly, I mean, at least the level of detail that we've got right now, it's not baked. At least they're not willing to share the level of detail that you need to really make a true assessment of just how much legs this thing has. I agree with you.
Yeah, so I give it a 5. You know, I give it in the MCX when we first heard about it range. Like, that was an important and powerful point. Had it happened, it would have been a game changer in the payments.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Because when you first mentioned the MCX comparison when we were talking earlier, I'm like, ooh, that's damning with faint praise. But if you're talking about the potential that MCX had back before they had some time to develop it and it never really took hold, then I can see where you're going with this. And I frankly give... you know, Mark and company, and you know, they've put together, they've got 27 partners they announced on this, and they claim they're going to have 100, or they aim to have 100 by the time they go live next year. And it's a pretty impressive list. So you got to figure that these people, I mean, if Facebook comes calling and they have an idea, I mean, I think everybody said they had to put in at least $10 million of equity into the idea. That's a relatively cheap price tag for the companies we're looking at on this list. I mean, they got Visa, MasterCard, PayPal to weigh in. Why wouldn't they want to be involved? You've got, you know, the natural folks that can use this currency as a way to be paid on the network. Uber, Spotify, Lyft, they're all involved. And then Stripe's in there. I mean, I think you've got a lot of, you know, I wouldn't say who's who, but you've got an awful lot of good, credible names in there.
I completely agree. But I would also say that so did MCX.
Yeah, that's okay. This is uncommon. I did not expect this. I'm actually maybe a little more excited about it than you were. And I'm not like over the moon, but I do think that it has potential.
Let me give you my pieces of it that are bothersome to me. One, it's not bothersome in the sense that Facebook creates a coin. Okay. So I'm not in that space just yet about their privacy. I'm going to believe what they say and believe that, okay, they will keep this separate. But so let's just assume that. But the actual network itself, one, when I look at the actual technology of it, it appears to be permissioned, which means that those companies you saw on that list are going to be really the community that runs this thing. Effectively, if you compare this to Bitcoin, those guys are the miners. And as we know from, you know, the Bitcoin politics that we've seen, the miners kind of run things to some extent. It's definitely a fight between the miners and the developers always.
Well, it's interesting. You got a plus and a minus on that one from what I see, because you get rid of a lot of the challenges around, one thing, you know, I think that, you know, the real Bitcoin zealots are not going to be happy about. They never said this, but I got to believe that there's no anonymity involved here. Everybody's going to know who's spending money. This is not an untraceable form of currency. Would you agree?
Yeah. You know, again, they didn't say it. That was my next thing is, I can't tell. There was a note in the glossary that said that approved gateways will allow you to be able to get into a, you know, as a starting point. So I'm assuming approved gateways will be people who can make attestations about who it is that they're, because you're taking real money. You know, that's the positive about it, is it is considered a stable coin in the sense that dollar for dollar in theory, which they actually have in their glossary here, a piece of that, but dollar for dollar in theory, but if you put in $10, you have $10 to spend there, and it's actually stored somewhere. It's not fake money.
I was going to mention, I mean, that's another one that, you know, we're not going to be in, you know, one of the things I've read that I think makes a lot of sense is they're actually creating obvious opportunities for you to spend this money. It's not just purely a gold, a safe where you just put your gold nuggets and don't do anything with them. And it's a store of value. So you shouldn't be seeing those rapid fluctuations in price. And for that matter, you know, I noticed that it hasn't done anything to the price of Bitcoin. I thought if anything, Bitcoin might go up a bit because of the visibility. Bitcoin is at a 13-month high, but it basically has been kind of unaffected by this announcement over the last 2 days.
Yeah. However, Facebook's stock went down.
It did? I didn't notice that. Wow.
Dropped a little bit yesterday. Yeah. You know, so that was interesting. You know, they talk about the Libre Association. It's a not-for-profit organization headquartered in Geneva, which tells me they knew that they were going to get, you know, I think yesterday Harris immediately, you know, freaked out and said she was going to send cease and desist orders from Congress.
Maxine Waters?
Pardon me. I was thinking Camille Harris. You're right. Okay. It's Maxine Waters. Camille Harris might have too. For some reason, that name is stuck in my head. But yeah, they had that. And then, you know, you can actually go in the account thing. You can learn a lot just from the glossary. The glossary is where I've actually learned the most about how this thing works.
Let's post that too. That, I mean, for people who really want to dig in, let's do that.
Yeah. So the Libra Reserve is the total money holdings that back Libra. to be a validator node. Remember, that's a validator node, not a mining node. So in theory, as a validator node, this runs a little like the Lightning version of Bitcoin, which is there's people who are actually like writing things down on the ledger. And then there's people who are going, yeah, we wrote this down on the ledger. You know, that's a validator node, but it is a requirement to invest in the reserve, which tells me it's a proof of stake type of concept, which was interesting as well. So even though it's permissioned, it does look like you could run a validator node. And I assume that's for the Nikes and, you know, I didn't see Amazon on the list. Did you?
Not yet. No, I've got to, I hadn't noticed, but you're right. They're conspicuous in their absence. And we'll see if they sign up a little bit further down the road or if they got their own items.
They got their own Amazon coin. Right. So, but yeah, this is, that was another piece that I noticed was, it lacks some of the natural governance, or it, in some ways, the purist will say that it's the fox guarding the hen house. That Bitcoin was created so that it wouldn't be in that mode, right? That the people who are really watching the ledger, you know, it's this trust mechanism that doesn't require trust. It spreads the trust across millions of accounts. Here you've got a council that you're going to have to trust. And that really is the core. When I read, you know, look on Twitter and I see the people going, yeah, I would never do anything with this. You know, it's the same people are going, yeah, you know, I don't want my money going to the Russian trolls, or I don't want to be tricked out of it by, you know, these fake accounts on Facebook, because they're having trouble separating these two, because, you know, Facebook obviously announced it, but clearly Libra is a consortium that's separate, no different than say Seal Ledger, you know, the platform that's out there.
And as you pointed out, too, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, I don't think that there's the same intentions and goals behind this as there was behind Bitcoin. But as I think you said this before we started rolling tape, that clearly this is an opportunity for Facebook to diversify their revenue streams, too. I mean, they've gone about as far as they can working with privacy. So this, if they can work with financial services, this may be a way to take a slice of some of the transaction revenue.
Well, and to take a pro view of it. So if you suddenly said, hey, Facebook user, I really want to know who you are and I want some KYC, most people would go, why? You don't need it.
Yeah, know your customer, just for people who are not geeking out like we are on this stuff.
Right. KYC. But if you said, hey, customer, if you want to use our Magic Libra, you know, wallet, it's time to connect your Facebook account to your Calibra account. That's actually kind of an interesting way to start validating all the people on Facebook.
I assume you're not going to have to connect it to that wallet. I'm assuming that, yeah, to me, that felt a little bit like Zelle. You know, Zelle has a standalone wallet. But
right.
I think that in many cases, I suspect that they will want most of this volume to run directly through WhatsApp and directly through Facebook Messenger. And if you've got to go load a separate app, that's your typical, you know, the friction that fintech companies are supposed to be getting rid of and online companies are supposed to be getting rid of. So we'll see how that plays out. Again, it's early.
Yeah, it really is. And so we'll see, because a council can change, right? But yeah, that was, you know, that was interesting to me. The other thing that is interesting to me is they used, so there's Libras, that's your kind of your fiat or your name. And then there's gas. And gas is kind of the how you pay for a transaction. So one thing that's very interesting to me is we have yet to know what the economics of this is in relation to, because it's not an open, it's an open system in terms of it's open source and the technology is open source, but the network itself is permissioned, meaning you can't just be a validator node. You can't just be a transaction node without going through the Libra Association. And so what are the economics of me sending $100 to you? Am I paying $5 for that? Am I paying five? What's gas? Is it a percentage of that transaction? Are they going to be able to go down to some, you know, 8 decimal points of precision for microtransactions?
They've made it clear that they want to make this more effective ways to, you know, make cross-border payments for people in other countries. That's one of the, you know, the financial inclusion plays they're talking about. But there's an awful lot of headroom. You can charge a lot of different things and still be below what's being charged today. So,
or do we'll find if out. If that's their big push, then is this an FX play?
Could be. And it's interesting because it's going to be backed by a bundle, a basket of currencies, not just the US dollar. You could argue it may be more stable than any one currency because it'll actually be a blended mix.
Right. And my point on that is from an FX, being sort of a fiat exchange, if you will, the idea that right now it's, you know, X amount of rubles to a dollar or whatever the, you know, trans thing is. And if I say, hey, Glenn, I'll give you these rubles and you give me the money, you have to lock down whatever that rate is for a certain amount of time, but it may be worth my time to hang on to the rubles that you just gave me for the dollars until it goes up. And then I make money on what you sent to me.
Which is precisely why nobody's spending Bitcoin, because it's always going up, or at least had been for a long time.
That's what I think could be happening here, because it seems to me that this is also a float play. All that money's got to go somewhere. Did you see a bank in the list of all those?
No, people? That's the other thing. That was very conspicuous. The closest thing I saw to a bank was BBVA's venture arm is there. But there is no bank on the list right now, which I definitely found very interesting. Well, anyway, there's going to be a ton more time to talk about this, and I'm sure we'll be doing more talking. In the meantime, please send those links along. We'll post them, and also a link to the Breaking Banks conversation, where I'm guessing you'll get into some more detail as well.
Absolutely, and I'll be working on the next stage of this. Is I want to look at they created their own language for these contracts, the smart contracts called Move. So I'm going to play that song from, what was it, Madagascar? You got to move it, and spend some time looking at that. That may be where the magic is. Maybe
I was thinking of the band The Move and Do Ya. We can do that one too.
Yeah, either one. You can play one or the other. But I'm going to look at that. There may be magic there. So let's not judge a book by its glossary cover.
And we'll go back and check the big deal-o-meter again in another month or so.
Yep.
Great. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Glenn.
So we'll post a link to John's video as well, and obviously be keeping tabs on exactly where that goes. Like I said before, on the big deal-o-meter, we'll see exactly how it plays out. Obviously, the regulatory aspects are, I think we all knew that was going to be one of the challenges, and it seems to be kind of coming home to roost already in terms of lots of people circling this one. So that'll be fun to keep watching. Let me just mention something else again for the folks who are new to the podcast. Many of you are familiar with Best Innovation Group for, as we say before, the cool technology that we do and products like Five, voice-activated banking, Set It Credit, distributed ledger technology, Big DLT. What I think is a very well-kept secret behind the curtain of all that is the consulting offerings of the Best Innovation Group, run by my good friend Kurt Kordaleski. Three major areas of consulting: data assessments, roadmaps and strategies there, digital transformation, and standard growth strategies as well for credit unions. I think the secret sauce in all this is it's run entirely. The group is entirely staffed with credit union veterans and professionals, literally hundreds of years of experience across the team. They understand the nuances of credit unions because they've all come from credit unions. And they do this at, I think, a price point that you'll find a little bit more reasonable than you would typically associate with consulting of this caliber. So I think it's worth your look. Take a look again at the website. There's a consulting tab at big-fintech.com. Get in contact if that looks like something that you think could be of value. And I do think it ought to be of some value. So, having said that, let's get back to the main attraction. Deirdre O'Gorman, as I mentioned before, has a lot of different accomplishments under her belt. She has been on this podcast before, and we'll post a link to her earlier episode, which would also be good background listening. But this tells us kind of where we're at right now with a lot of really interesting topics around the fact that we're still dealing with cash and whatnot in the space of cannabis banking. With no further ado, my conversation with Deirdre O'Gorman. So thanks again to Deirdre O'Gorman for agreeing to join us. I went back into the archives and discovered Deirdre, I think it was almost exactly 2 years ago to the day that you talked to John Best here on the Big Cast, and taking the time to do so again. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for asking me back.
So Deirdre, I will introduce you a couple of different ways. Right now, I think your primary role is as the founder of DX Consulting, and we'll get into that a bit. You also are, is it the CEO, or what is your role at Imperial Logistics?
Yeah, I'm a founder and CEO of Imperial Logistics. It's a cash transport armored service provider.
And then people, when you talked to John last time, the focus of your conversation, and I think where people may be the most familiar in seeing your name in the press, is you are the CEO of the Fourth Corner Credit Union, which has a charter, correct, in the state of Colorado, but has not yet begun operations as a, I don't want to misstate this, a cannabis-focused credit union.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. The credit union is still very much alive and thriving, but the doors are not open. As many of you remember from the last podcast that we were on, the fourth corner ran into some challenges getting deposit insurance. And then ultimately that denial led to a denial with the Federal Reserve Bank for access to a master account. So since then, the fourth corner went through litigation and was able to reach settlement with the Federal Reserve Bank. And as a result of that settlement, the fourth corner is now retooling our charter. And we're working with the Colorado Division of Financial Services to retune that so that we can eventually open our doors and help in any way we can. With the settlement, however, we're not serving direct license holders. And what I mean by that is MRBs that have licenses within the state of Colorado to grow or touch the plant.
MRB, marijuana-related business, is that?
Yes, okay. That's exactly
wow.
Right.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
So I'll post a link to the earlier episode. I think it's got a lot of great background. At the time, I believe you had not yet run into some of these challenges. And I think that really gives people a way to kind of go back if they want to get into the details. But obviously, I think of anybody who is well-versed in the topic of the benefits of banking these businesses and the challenges, both regulatory and on the street, I think you're probably as well-versed as anybody. And that's actually given rise to your work at DX Consulting, because I think since then, as you've continued to work on Fourth Corner, you spent a great bit of your time really consulting with other institutions, trying to understand how they may have a play in this space, right?
That's right. So with the fourth corner, we had some heavy hitters on the BSA and compliance side working alongside the team to architect what we felt was a really strong BSA. And we're talking about people that lead the industry, people that have developed the ACAMS testing that most BSA officers sit for the test and become certified, as well as anti-money laundering experts. And so we had a pretty tight program. But unfortunately, I think the press did two things. One, it was really great to be able to further the movement and get the conversation moving forward. But the negative of that was that I think there was a lot of misperceptions about the charter.
You were on the bleeding edge, too. I mean, this was two years ago. I mean, the amount, and I've got an article that by the time we run this will be live, I believe, on the web from Credit Union Magazine around cannabis banking. And just in the time that I've kind of been pursuing this topic, not nearly as long as you have, but for the last year or so, the amount of comfort in terms of people dealing with this has risen quite a bit. Even having said that, banks, financial institutions, for good reason, tend to try to be very quiet about the way they approach this. And I think one thing to debunk is, the Cannabis Credit Union, you were not going to be like a 100% weed financial institution. Can you kind of clarify in concentration risk and whatnot?
Absolutely. So we had capped it at 25% of our asset size that was going to be direct license holders, so plant-touching entities. The rest was a community charter that we were working with ancillary businesses, employees of the industry, as well as supporters of the cannabis legalization movement. So yeah, that was, I think, one of the setbacks that we experienced, is that a lot of regulators and people that we were trying to engage in conversations with didn't realize that we didn't have a concentration risk. But tip of the hat to Colorado Division of Financial Services, they would have never put a charter in place if it was a concentration risk. There's very smart people over there. And I think we just somehow just couldn't get the story out that that's not the mission of the credit union.
It's such a sexy headline. I mean, the cannabis credit union, how can you avoid? And in an earlier conversation, you mentioned to me as well, you never would have taken a job leading a credit union that had that type of concentration risk. I mean, it's just silly.
Yeah, I've been in banks and credit unions for 24 years, so I know my way around. I've been part of the senior leadership team on many different types of all sizes of financial institutions. So I do know that it'd be career suicide if I would have gone to a one-trick pony financial institution.
Now, I remember you had a very high-powered and impressive-looking board of directors. You've mentioned already people with Bank Secrecy Act compliance experience and things like that. They're still on board and in place and moving the ball forward?
That's the amazing thing about the fourth corner, is everybody is still on board. We have not lost any of our amazing board members or leaders on the team. So it says something about the group of people we put together and about their passion for the movement and getting this banking conversation moving forward.
And it wasn't until I went back and listened to the episode that you did with John back 2 years ago that I understood the definition or the relevance of the term fourth corner. And the fourth corner being basically completing the process of the financial institution need to actually move this industry forward. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right.
And so obviously, and in the meantime, you know, you were the trailblazer, but there are some institutions now that have, you know, been willing, very brave ones who have taken the lead in terms of being public about the fact that they are banking these types of organizations. MAPS Credit Union out in Salem, Oregon comes to mind. Rachel Pross, who's chief risk officer and has testified in front of Congress, obviously a leader in the space. Numerica in Washington State and OB Credit Union in Washington State. Any others that come to your mind kind of top of the list that are willing to acknowledge that they're in this space?
Yeah, absolutely. So Partner Safe Harbor Credit Union based out of Colorado has an amazing CEO, Sundy Siegfried. She's been a trailblazer as well. And I think, you know, honestly, a de novo financial institution, I get why regulators might have had a little heartburn around it since no one was stepping up at the time. But since then, we have a lot of amazing financial institutions that have decided to, you know, take up the gauntlet and are doing this. And in some ways, it's even more challenging for them because they have legacy systems. They had staff that learned kind of old ways of doing things. They didn't understand the new BSA protocols. So they had to really develop a system that was unlike anything they already had in place. So my hat goes off to them as well.
Can you talk a bit about, I mean, obviously, as we said, you've spent a lot of time consulting with organizations, whether they're actively looking to get involved or just wanting to understand the landscape to see how it may affect them. And without divulging any confidences, what are the types of questions that you get from folks who are really trying to kick the tires here?
Yeah, so most of the financial institutions that reach out to me, it's one of two things. They're either trying to figure out, hey, legalization is coming to my state. It's medical, or it's also medical and recreational cannabis, and trying to figure out, what am I going to do next? Do I want to bank this industry? Do I want to, you know, just basically do a risk assessment with you so I can figure out where my deltas are? Or it's the opposite of that. I want to build the ring fence around my financial institution. We do not want to get in this industry. How do I insulate my FI from this activity? What do I need to put in place?
And we've had this conversation before as well. That's kind of a fallacy, isn't it? I mean, it's virtually impossible to really insulate yourself entirely from adjacent businesses and things along those lines.
You know, it really depends upon the market, but absolutely, it is challenging in some respects, especially when you have a very prolific medical and recreational market, and you have lots of licenses issued by the state. Now, some states have taken an approach that's very prudent, and they are extremely conservative with how many licenses that they have adopted within their state. And so it's a little easier in certain jurisdictions, whereas others, it's almost impossible, because it just becomes part of the daily, you know, economics of your state. You have people shopping at Home Depot. You have the employees of the industry that are, you know, trying to, you know, buy cars and are consumers. And so it eventually will touch your financial institution despite anyone's best efforts.
Well, the example I heard is, I mean, a contractor, you know, whether a plumber or electrician who is called in to do wiring for one of these businesses. Are they technically now not allowed? You know, they can't deposit that money. I mean, I've heard that there are some major banks that if they see anything in the name of a business that's actually paying them, you know, if it says something about cannabis or something, that they won't accept the check, which just to me doesn't make a ton of sense.
Well, so everybody has their own BSA tolerance. And I think that the best thing that you can do is be proactive. And you know, a good defense is a great offense kind of thing. And so if you could define what that qualifies in your mind as, so the FinCEN guidance calls out ancillary businesses, so businesses that serve the cannabis industry, very specifically in a footnote. And so I always urge my FIs to make sure that you understand what an ancillary business is and how you define it at your financial institution, and then risk rate it. So if 50% of their business is based in cannabis, then they're going to be a higher risk member or customer for you. So you need to identify that and say what you're going to do as your BSA protocols for those types of accounts. And then maybe you have others that are, you know, have an account here or two, but the majority of their revenue is not derived from the cannabis industry. Then maybe they're more on the traditional side and you don't have the robust BSA lift that you would on plant touching direct license holders or those tier two clients.
I mean, that makes a ton of sense to me. I mean, I'm just thinking again about the electrician or somebody like that putting in lighting for a grow operation or something. I mean, yeah, if they've got, you know, a client that calls them in, I don't see why they should be tainted. On the other hand, if they're doing 50%+ of their business with cannabis businesses, then I can see a different story. But I doubt there's too many electricians that are focused entirely on the cannabis industry. Maybe in a place like Colorado, maybe there is that kind of a niche at some point. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's more in the professional services arena where we see consultants or attorneys that have decided to really focus their practice on that particular subset, but or payroll companies, payment providers. But typically, yeah, your contractors and the people that provide other types of goods and services, they have other types of business and revenue coming in.
That's a good point. I know of a regional accounting firm down here in Atlanta that is actually, I think, it kind of just stumbled into it, frankly, from what I can understand, has developed a specialty in craft breweries. There's just, you know, enough specialty around the regulation and the accounting about how you deal with that. So now they have some degree of a concentration, a specialty practice around that. Well, you could kind of assume the same kind of logic could apply. And if prohibition were still in place in the 1920s, I guess they'd be a tainted industry.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
The other thing, and you mentioned already car loans, which I find interesting, the whole idea of employees. I love this one quote in the Credit Union Magazine article about the, you know, employees who were receiving their checks from cannabis businesses basically were frozen out of the marketplace themselves. And I love the one quote that one of the employees actually said, "I am so stoked about direct deposit," when their employer finally got a bank account, was able to pay them that way. I mean, I think that the ACH people would be overjoyed. How often do you hear someone being stoked about direct deposit? But I mean, it just, again, kind of speaks to some of the challenges as this business mainstreams. If you don't have financial services, you have a real problem.
I think that that's an unspoken issue that people don't often realize, is that the employees of the industry are becoming disenfranchised. They are either paid in cash, or, you know, if their employer finally gets a bank account and then for some reason or other loses that bank account because the financial institution decided not to get into it, or their regulator decided not to allow them to do it, the industry really has an employee issue. And so that's one of the areas where the fourth corner is really going to focus our efforts, is on those employee connections. And then I'm also urging a lot of my financial institutions that I work with through DX and through Imperial, if you, you know, really want a loyal member or customer at your financial institution, bank the employees, because they know what it's like not to have banking, and they realize how inconvenient and hard it is. So they're very motivated to do whatever you need them to do.
Yeah, everything I've heard is that the businesses that actually do get banked are among the most compliant you're going to find, because they, again, value these relationships so much and realize what there is to lose. So, you know, if they're interested in getting involved in the financial marketplace in the first place, they're probably going to be willing to bend over backwards to meet the compliance requirements.
Yeah, they would lose a lot if they lost their license. In some cases, it's hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. So they're motivated to do whatever it takes to be compliant with local and state rules and be that great member or customer for your financial institution. They want to do things right, for sure.
Now, I know we've had this conversation before as well. I know it's incredibly difficult to really come up with an estimate of how many financial institutions, banks and credit unions, and I know that there's on both sides of that divide, you've got participants in the space, mostly smaller institutions, that it's difficult to really define how many are actively engaged in this space. And I guess part of it is even defining, you know, what is actively engaged. You might be pursuing business, or you may have wound up discovering that one of your existing clients has moved into it and maybe decided to keep it quiet and be willing to kind of keep going, but not market the fact that you're doing that. Any thought in terms of the way that trend may be changing and people's willingness to acknowledge that they're banking these businesses?
Yeah, so I think as we start to, you know, look at the FinCEN guidance and get the reporting from FinCEN on the SAR reportings, we're definitely seeing that trend line moving up. There are more financial institutions getting into the space. Last November, they reported 486 financial institutions, and it's been going up about anywhere from 15 to 30%, depending upon the quarter, of new entrants into that space. So I'm guessing right now it would be about 500. We're all waiting for the latest FinCEN report on that. But yeah, definitely more financial institutions are feeling comfortable. And I think when we have the national conversation about Safe Banking Act and the States Act and all of the conversations that are happening in DC, that's helping financial institutions get a little bit more confident that maybe this is an area that they should start to explore.
At least explore, even if not getting engaged, so you don't, right, you know, start from a cold stop when something actually is allowed.
That's exactly right.
I think it's worth pointing out, too. I think it's an interesting conversation. The whole notion of the SAR, just for people who are not familiar, SAR, Suspicious Activity Report, the compliance effort, if a FI does decide to get involved in this, you have to understand that this is a very labor-intensive exercise, and you can price for it accordingly as well. That's a fair statement?
That's exactly right. So people are always surprised when they get into this space and they start to learn about the industry, just how regulated it is. So most states mandate a seed-to-sale tracking mechanism that will not allow any plants in or out of the system. It's not like a typical inventory tracking system that you and I are familiar with, where you, if you, you know, spill some food on the floor, if I'm a restaurant, or if you know, a dress gets ripped, if I'm a retail establishment, I can delete that out of my inventory. Not so with the cannabis industry. They have to regulate and track every little item that's in and out of their stores, or grow houses, or MIPS. So what we really like to focus on with our financial institutions is you actually know more about these clients or members than you do about anybody else in your portfolio. So you're getting access to their POS system, their seed-to-sale tracking system. You understand their business plan. You're looking at all the payments and transactions going in and out of these accounts. And so in some ways, it's almost more safe for your financial institution to bank these players and know what's happening in your community, as opposed to shutting your doors.
Yeah, it's ironic. You mentioned POS, point of sale system. And at the end of the day, though, regardless of whether these institutions are banked, we're still talking about a cash business, because no one is allowed to accept credit or debit cards for this, correct?
That's right. So we are still predominantly a cash focused industry. And that's what one of the reasons why I started Imperial Logistics. So I had worked for a large financial institution that was about $17 billion in assets, and we moved a lot of cash on behalf of our franchisees that were in the fast food space and a lot of retail establishments. So I saw back then that there was a system that was broken with those old transport providers. You have the big steel cage vehicles that are extremely expensive and break down a lot. And also feels like, to me, had a big target on them, because you know exactly what's in those those big vehicles. And then beyond that, we feel like there's the firearms issue. I don't know if you've ever been held up before, but me being in the bank and credit union space, I've been in multiple robberies. And as much as you know, firearms might be helpful in other scenarios, it was never helpful in my experience in those. In fact, it escalated the situation. So I think transport was ready for disruption on many different fronts. And so that was one of the reasons why I started the transport company, because I felt like this model could be better. We can track and trace through technology. Firearms will be strategic if they're necessary. And at the end of the day, we can do this cheaper and better and service not only the cannabis banks and credit unions, but then also the traditional side of the equation and save them lots of time and money.
I was going to say, to be clear, your focus there with Imperial Logistics is not solely on cannabis. That's, you know, one of the key factors that it makes sense for that industry, but it applies much more broadly.
That's exactly right. We actually have just as many traditional clients as we have banks and credit unions that are in the cannabis space.
And again, given, I don't think we've ever mentioned that you are based in Colorado, so obviously there's a natural opportunity there and a niche market for you to be focusing in cannabis. You know, the other piece that, you know, we talked already about the public safety issue, you know, by definition, yes, you know, an armored truck is an obvious target. Everybody knows what it's there for. But if you know that a cannabis business is an entirely cash operation, you pretty much know that there's cash sitting there too, which is not exactly a pleasant thing to have to deal with.
Well, and that's why I think financial institutions were so surprised that the traditional transport providers weren't offering any services in this space, or if they did, it was very limited. So that's why we've actually had exponential growth. We're servicing over 10 states right now with multiple different clients and multiple different jurisdictions, because the traditional providers just aren't in the space. And the other thing that I think is just important to note is that most of the financial institutions that are in this space, they don't want cash at their branches because they're trying to protect their current clientele, members, customers. And so it makes sense as an extra layer of safety to have someone else who's specialized in this and knows the protocols to provide that service.
That's a good point. We started to go down the road a little bit of the suspicious activity reports. And I think that name is a bit of a misnomer. I mean, yes, well, suspicion doesn't mean guilt. But, you know, the fact is that there's a disproportionate number of SARs by definition that get filed around cannabis businesses. If you're in this business, you're going to be filing SARs for your clients. Isn't that the way it works?
That's absolutely right. So FinCEN actually had some foresight into this, and they decided to put marijuana-based SARs in place so that they basically are getting the information they need. There's the transparency that needs to happen for the industry and for the financial institutions serving them. But at the same time, it's more, I think, an update, I think is the best way to put it. Unless it's a priority or a termination SAR, those are saying, hey, we think that something is going on with this account. We're raising the red flag. And then ultimately the termination SAR is we've decided to not bank this business any longer. But the typical ongoing SARs, those are just reporting to FinCEN the activity and making sure that everybody knows the beneficial owners, what's happening with the account, and being transparent.
So again, you mentioned, and I think the metric you gave is we're closing in on 500. I guess the way you do that is by sorting on marijuana-oriented SARs is how we get that number. But I think, at least my impression, tell me if I'm wrong, is that there are not 500 institutions yet that are actively like raising a banner saying, you know, we are accepting cannabis business. I think it's a much smaller number that's willing to really go public with that. Am I correct there?
Well, so that's such a hard metric to be able to unravel. But I agree with you. There are some that are filing those SARs with FinCEN that are termination SARs or that are priority SARs saying, hey, we just discovered this account. We didn't know we had it. So until we actually get some concrete numbers, absolutely, it's the 500 is not a reliable metric. So what I really like to look at is the SAR filings and just the increase in the breakdown of SARs. The priority SARs and the termination SARs, I'm not as interested in those.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I think that there are probably, I wouldn't even want to hazard a guess, but in the double digits of financial institutions that are doing this at scale. And then the rest are starting either to get into it with a small percentage of their assets or just total deposits. And others just, hey, we had this account. We believe in this member or customer, and we want to continue the relationship, but we're keeping it only to the relationships we had on our portfolio prior to legalization in our state.
Yeah, I mean, it's a touchy subject, and it's interesting because, and as I was writing this article for Credit Union Magazine, it came to my mind a couple times as well, you know, including not only the banks who are a little bit uncomfortable, banks and credit unions, they don't want to run afoul of their regulators, but they also, the companies that they are banking tend to not really want to be too public about that because, again, they're afraid that if it becomes too well known, that they're going to start getting pressured and they may wind up losing that access to banking services, which they don't want to lose, which just kind of creates this vicious cycle because it kind of keeps everything undercover when the bottom line is, you know, I think from a public safety aspect, I think we can probably agree that it makes more sense. And I mean, a lot of the wording I've seen, in fact, I think I got a quote from somebody from the state of Colorado that, you know, it's far better to have access to know what's going on in the daylight than not having the ability to understand what's being transacted.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that all the people that are involved in this take their responsibilities very seriously. And I mean, you always have the outliers. You'll have, you know, certain players that were bad actors to begin with. But by and large, this is an industry of compliant people who are heavily regulated. And I think a lot of people don't realize are cash strapped. They don't have traditional vehicles that you and I would have enjoy as entrepreneurs to be able to finance their business. So they're bootstrapping it. And any other, you know, any issue that comes up, they're very worried that they're going to lose that banking relationship because it's expensive to have your entire industry based in cash.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out that even the institutions that are banking these businesses, it's almost entirely on transaction-based services. It's holding an account, keeping money for safekeeping, doing payroll, you know, issuing checks, things along those lines. They're not lending for the most part because I think that's still considered to be somewhat more touchy conversation. So there's still limitations.
That's exactly right. So the industry is forced to go to hard money lenders. They pay, you know, anywhere from 15 to 21% interest on a lot of their loans. Some of them have been able to tap into equity with, you know, prior success, you know, business success that they've had, or they end up going to Canada. Now that it's legal in Canada, they try to go public on the Toronto Stock Exchange. They're doing reverse mergers. In some ways, the Canadian legalization is changing the industry and disintermediating a lot of the U.S.-based businesses because they're looking for cash. They're looking for that influx. And so the only place that they can go is Canada.
Hmm. You mentioned, you know, the probably double digit organizations doing this at scale. The ones that come to the top of my mind, again, I mentioned before, MAPS Credit Union, Numerica, OB. You threw in the Safe Harbor. I believe Vermont State Employees Credit Union is involved. I'm not sure if I consider that to be at scale. But you know, one of the things that's interesting, and I think you've kind of answered this question already, you know, given that Fourth Corner originally started with the notion that there was a need out there, we've had a few institutions, not a lot, but a few that have stepped up to kind of fill that gap. Is that need? I think clearly the industry is growing, so it's still plenty of room to grow. But as you've said, you're not going to be in a position to actually bank at Fourth Corner those direct licensed marijuana businesses. You're going to the next level of tertiary businesses, supporting professional services, employees, et cetera. That's the approach?
That's right. So obviously, we're still working with Colorado Division of Financial Services, DFS, to really fine tune what our field of membership will look like. But yeah, definitely the employees of the industry, the ancillary businesses that serve the industry, since the 2018 Farm Bill, we're exploring the hemp and CBD side. We're still a little nervous about that because we haven't gotten the rules and regulations around that clarified yet. But it's definitely something that we're looking at. And then also for the financial institutions that are in the space that don't necessarily want to use their master account or their correspondent credit union or bank, then maybe the Fourth Corner could help them. I think we're exploring lots of different avenues to try to figure out what would be the best model for a long-term safety and soundness.
That's interesting. So something like hemp actually makes you a little bit more nervous right now, I guess, just because of the lack of clarity. Because I'm just, you know, I would think that might, you know, kind of get some of the mystique out of it and make it a little bit more acceptable.
Yeah. You know, I actually, if I were sitting in a CEO's chair right now, no industry experience at all, I would think that the Farm Bill was a helpful way for me to get comfortable with the industry and move forward. But I actually recommend to my clients steer clear.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. It's the regulatory guidance has not been clarified yet. The FDA and the USDA still haven't had their rulemaking. There's supposed to be a meeting on May 31st to kind of start that process. But former heads of those agencies have gone on record saying that, hey, wait a minute, we haven't been able to prove out claims that CBD is medically effective. So adding it to food and other supplements, we need to hold on and do some more research. I know that Congress wanted to move this forward, and so they provided a good blueprint, but it really doesn't provide financial institutions any sort of ability to regulate or know what they need to look out for. And I think the other thing that people don't realize is that it's such a low level of THC. So THC is the cannabinoid component within hemp and cannabis that becomes psychotropic. So the more that you have a THC concentration in that plant, the more psychotropic it becomes.
Just like alcohol content in beer.
That's exactly right. Okay. Yeah. So with the low THC mandate for hemp, it's 0.3%. It has to be under that threshold. What most people don't realize is that plant can get hot. And what I mean by that is it can have a spike or a surge in THC after the fact. So we're seeing kind of case law right now unfolding as this national conversation is occurring, because there's been situations where people thought, oh, under the Farm Bill, I can take this hemp across state lines, I'm good to go, and didn't realize that some of their plant concentrations got hot and had that spike. And so you could have, in one case, 18,000 pounds of hemp, the majority of it can be tested and prove out as hemp, but there might be a few plants in there that had that surge, and that's technically cannabis. And now they could be in trouble.
Wow. Is that something that can somebody game the system by kind of inducing it to get hot? Or is it something that just happens totally at random? Do you know enough about that?
You know, in my knowledge, it happens completely randomly. But I would have to get my hemp experts in. And I know banking, but I don't know botany as well.
That's interesting. I'd never heard that one before. That's fascinating. Well, you know, this probably is a great way to kind of lead into a closing topic looking forward as we talk about the regulatory aspects of CBD and hemp. What about the regulatory aspects? What do you see going forward, the regulatory environment? I know we have the SAFE Act we've referred to already before, which is going through Congress, and I believe it's called the States Act, which is the one that was taking place in the Senate. Do I have that right?
That's right. And, you know, although I applaud both bills and appreciate the legislative efforts on behalf of the industry, they don't go far enough. Unfortunately, they don't give the financial institution any sort of clarity on that delta between their federal deposit insurance and their federal regulators in some cases. It tries to carve it out, but I feel like it doesn't go far enough, and it still keeps the cannabis on the Controlled Substances Act. So until it is removed from that, I really do feel like it's still a gray area for most financial institutions, and even more so for payments companies. So Visa, MasterCard, Discover, if I were in their shoes, I wouldn't feel comfortable allowing credit card transactions until that's clarified.
Really? Even after getting that kind of approval from the SAFE Act in the states? When you say controlled substance, I mean, wouldn't the same argument apply for pharmaceuticals? I mean, you can use your credit card to buy mail order pharmacy products.
And that's the fallacy about this whole thing is that until we get at least a green light to do more research and be able to prove out some of this stuff, we actually have cannabis as a Schedule I, whereas oxycodone is a Schedule II. And so our national conversation
Help me out again.
Really is one, starting
one,
to pivot.
One meaning that it's more severe than
the most
that?
Dangerous, the most have the highest potential for abuse and no medical efficacy.
So given all the other press about the opioid epidemic, oxycodone still winds up lower ranked.
That's right.
Amazing. Okay. But you could probably buy oxycodone with a credit card, couldn't you?
Yes, you could.
I guess we can leave it at that. Deidre, thanks so much. I've learned a lot. I hope our listeners agree that this has been a fascinating conversation. If people want to learn, I guess you've got three hats, as you say, any or all of them, if they want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to find out more about your many enterprises?
Yeah, so they're welcome to email me at dogorman@dxconsulting.co, like Colorado.
Great. And websites, is there anything out there that people can track down that way?
Yeah, imperiallogistics.com and then the fourthcornercreditunion.com.
We'll post those links. And Imperial is actually with an E, correct?
E-M-P-Y-R-E-A-L.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
So I don't think we're ever going to get away from the BSA, Bank Secrecy Act, for those not steeped in the acronyms, and the compliance aspects of dealing with these challenges around cannabis banking. And I found the point that she makes about hemp not being nearly as straightforward as a lot of people seem to claim it is. I'd never even heard of this thing about hemp becoming hot. And then, again, from a financial inclusion standpoint, I think that the employee issues around this, not just banking the businesses, but these employees that are working at these companies, I think is, a lost story in many, many ways that comes out of this. One other update, Jeremy Empel, who works in the legislative governmental relations field at the California Credit Union League, which obviously has a dog in this hunt as well from a cannabis banking standpoint, had a good conversation with him out at the Government Affairs Conference of CUNA's back earlier this year. He gave me a little bit of an update, too, and in terms of where some of this legislation's going. We've talked about the SAFE Act and the STATES Act. There's a sidebar on that in the article. And he just gave me an update of where we stand. And, not surprisingly, this is not a clear path and a very quick resolution. I think people are really getting educated and understanding some of the issues behind this. And particularly in the House of Representatives, there definitely does seem to be traction. The challenge is the pecking order of national priorities in terms of what needs to get done. There's just the minor kind of business of funding a government and kind of keeping the lights on, and the appropriations bills, for good reason, wind up first in line before we deal with things like the SAFE Act and cannabis banking. Having said that, he believes that we're still on track in the House to get something passed that would address some of these issues before the House goes on recess in August. That's the good news. The Senate is a longer play. It doesn't seem to be nearly as high on their radar, and there seems to be a couple of other hurdles there. Nothing that I would consider to be active resistance, but it just, again, doesn't seem to be quite as front and center in their minds and lacks the champions of a Senator Perlmutter Representative Perlmutter from Colorado and people like that who are willing to really kind of move the ball forward. So, we'll continue to watch this space. No relief in sight yet from a legislative standpoint that would take the pressure off as far as the risks of these banking, which would hopefully make things a little bit more straightforward, but we'll obviously continue to watch that. With that, another episode of The Big Cast. My name is Glenn Sarvati. Thanks so much for checking in with us. You can find me on Twitter at 154advisors. You can find the Best Innovation Group on Twitter at Big Fintech, or visit the website, big-fintech.com. We're here every Tuesday with new content. I believe next week, 4th of July weekend, we're going to play a Greatest Hits episode. I work with John and find one of the ones that we think particularly deserves, not just your typical rerun. We'll try to find something that is either newly topical once again, or something that we think deserves some added attention. And then we've got a lot of other great new content coming up, including an interview with a gentleman from Brazil, a big e-commerce company doing a lot of interesting things called Magazine Luiza. And that's coming up in the near future as well. Until then, again, thanks for checking us out. Subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, or find us at the website, big-fintech.com. Every Tuesday, you should find some new content. Thanks again for listening.
Got a question or want to join the conversation? We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at Big Fintech, email us at info@big-fintech.com, or visit our show notes and comments at www.bigfintechmedia.com.